This is the first taped interview with Colin Barnes in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 7th of the 9th, 2000, for the RSL and Veterans Affairs Oral History Project, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Colin, I thought we should start by you telling us your full name and where and when you were born, please.
My name's Colin Egerton Barnes. I was actually born in a hospital in Cottesloe Beach, I'm told, and then brought home here to 36 Stirling Highway, Nedlands, the corner of Archdeacon Street. It was then Perth Fremantle Road, of course.
What year?
1923, October 1923.
I'm interested, if you could, to give us a brief rundown of your career, what you've spent your life doing.
Oh, well, it's been quite ordinary. I spent till the age of about 8 or 9, I think, I was at Nedlands Primary School. From there I went to Christchurch Grammar School. I wasn't there very long, and my parents sent me as a boarder at the age of 10 to Guildford Grammar School, primary school. Mm-hmm. Went through the primary and through the whole school, and while I was at the school, of course, the war broke out. One of the masters, Dick Glyde his name was, immediately joined the Air Force and went home to England, and he only lasted a matter of weeks before he was a casualty. Mm-hmm. Then all the talk was this, that and the other, and in those days, of course, you couldn't get in the Air Force unless you were smart. Mm. You had to be good. Mm. And because we came from this school and this type of education, most of them were pretty bright, and they all rushed off and joined the Air Force, and sadly to say, most of them were air crew and most of them never came back. I think I looked at a casualty list up there from school when I was up there about 5 months ago. There were 85 people on it, and I think I knew 84 of them. I'd been to school or through the school. It was very heavily, nearly all in the Air Force.
Before?
So I left the school, and then I had to do something, and in 1939 or 40 or whatever it was, work was pretty hard to get, and I finished up working down the next corner of the local greengrocer, a deli shop. I worked there for a while until I saw an ad in the paper for Dreyer's Dairy, which was just over the road in Hollywood, and I applied, got on the end of the line of about 40 or 50 people, and somehow or other I got the job. I don't know why I got the job. It was for £2.15 a week, and probably the average man was earning about £1 a week, or something like that, £1.10. But I found out that it was for 7 days a week. You worked all day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and only half a day Sunday. And that was doing everything. It was a one-man show. I stoked the fire under the boiler to get the steam to clean the cans. I unloaded the trucks that brought the milk in. I chilled it. I pasteurized it. I bottled it. I did the cream. I cleaned the bottles. And I did that for 12 hours a day. And I think it was from there, not much longer, I was probably there 6 or 8 months or something, and my parents got me a job at Woolworths in Perth, a very menial job. I think the least you could get is to empty the rubbish bags in Woolworths, and as the men got called up and went to the war, I of necessity rose up the ranks to the display department, which was at least you wore a grey dust coat, and you know, and so you looked the part and had Woolworths emblazoned on it. And by now, of course, you knew you were going to get the dreaded call-up notice when your 18th birthday came. Well, just before that, I was asked by Woolworths if I'd go down to Bunbury as a junior floor walker. Oh, you know, in those days, couldn't get a job 1 minute, and the next minute you're being promoted to junior floor walker in Bunbury. You'll be living at the Rose Hotel. Oh, the Rose Hotel in those days was something. And I never got there. I got my call-up notice, I think I got that my birthday was in October. I probably got it the day after my birthday or something. Mm-hmm. And I was called up to the Claremont Drill Hall very early in January 1942.
We'll come back and talk about the war. After the war, you worked in the family business, didn't you?
Yes, well, after the war, I had time to think while I was in the army, washing bottles and working in the da-di-da, you know, and I thought, oh, hang on, my parents have got a reasonable little business, and that's where there'd be more butter on my bread there, so use your brains. So I came home and then started to work for them, and they decided I should go elsewhere and learn the trade, so they sent me to the Eastern States in one of the suppliers, Farriers, and I went and did, through the Army Rehabilitation Training Scheme, it was called, I went there for 4 years to learn the trade. The Army paid all of your wages for a while, and they gradually paid less, and their employer paid more as you got more skills. So I went there, it's like an apprenticeship, so I virtually did a 4-year apprenticeship.
How long did you then end up working in the family business?
Goodness, about 30 years, I think.
And it was what sort of business was it?
Well, they were farriers, firstly, but then, of course, during that they started as farriers, but during the Depression they had to go into all various other things, so they went into all women's outerwear, coats and frocks and everything but underwear, you know. So it was generally a ladies' outfitters. It was a frock salon, really. But my trade was as a farrier. I was trained as a farrier, and extremely interesting, and I loved it. So, and during that period of time, of course, my parents eventually, well, quite soon actually, in the early 50s, left the business and left it to me. And in 1969, I think it was, I nominated and joined the Netherlands Council, and I was there for 30 years. For 23 years I was a councillor, and for 7 I was the mayor. And I retired from that in May 1999, so I spent a fair bit of time doing that. One of the interests of my life, I thought it was a great advantage to have done that. I learnt a heck of a lot through doing it. And since then I'm what they call a self-funded retiree, and I'm looking after my self-funds to help my retirement. I live here with my wife Leslie, and I have a son Brett who's about 45 years of age. Strangely enough, he lives in the same street, just up the road.
And you haven't actually moved out of this house for any length of time since you were a child, have you?
Oh, well, no, I was born and brought back here, and I grew up here, and in those days you didn't wait till you were 16 and move in with your girlfriend somewhere. You stayed there, and I stayed here. I was 32, I think, when I left and got married to Leslie Oliver, who lived across the road up here, up Stirling Highway. And what's the point of going anywhere else? We just move further up Archdeacon Street. Well, we live here on the corner of Archdeacon and Stirling. So we went up to Archdeacon Street, up the other end. We were there for about 40 years, and my parents passed on. We came back to this property where I grew up, built a new house, and here we are again. And my son went to our old house up there, knocked it down and built a new one. And so he's starting to suck around the same circle. Yes, we haven't moved far.
If we can go back, I'd like you to, if you can, tell us a little bit about your family life as a young chap growing up in Netherlands. What were your parents' names?
Florence May was my mother, and my father was William Edgerton Barnes.
And you're the only child?
I'm the only son. I had two sisters. One's deceased. The other one lives in Victoria. She was a nurse. My other sister was a zoologist. Well, really, I grew up in a boarding school at Guildford, but I mean, came home for holidays, and my earlier memories are from the state school, I suppose, as a very young child. But Netherlands was like everywhere else in those days. I mean, the whole thing has just been a growing thing, from gravel roads and milk being delivered by hand, and the paper by horse and cart. The man had a stack of papers and he rolled them up as he went along, rolled them and put a kink in them so they wouldn't unroll them, like boomerang shape, and then chucked them over your fence. They weren't in plastic bags or anything else. And he had a horse and cart that, and the same with the milk, and the horse knew the round for the paper and for the milk. And we were on first name terms with all of them, with the milkman. And as I say, there were gravel roads in those days, and there's lots of bush around, and there were right opposite across, there's nothing built on the two corners of Williams Road in those days, right opposite this house. There were two enormous, what they call hoardings. They were right across the diagonal of the block. I don't know what the dimensions would have been. That probably at least 60 feet long and 20 to 30 feet high, I suppose. And I can remember one was, they changed from time to time, but I can remember one for some airways, ANZ Airways or National Airways, I think it was, you know, fly to Adelaide or Sydney or somewhere for £21, And the other one I remember saying was for Chevrolet cars, for General Motors, where you could pay £33 and get a new car every year. If you traded your old one in every year, you paid £33. That's just relative prices.
Stirling Highway is obviously the main artery between Fremantle and Perth. What was that like?
Oh, well, it was the Perth-Fremantle Road. And before the war, it had been built by the convicts with wood as a base. The base was made of wood, and there were rounds of wood cut off, not corduroy shape, and put down. Then the road was over the top. It was a pretty rugged road. Of course, it wasn't all that good. Then I remember when they sort of built it during the Depression, and they took all that out. We kids scabbed up all the wood that was under it. We took as much as we could, but it was being burnt eternally on the job. And even when we pulled this house down in 1989 or something, some of that wood was still here, still waiting to be burnt in the fireplace. And then they built it by hand, literally. You watched them lay the foundation, and I actually watched men pick up a stone, probably 3 or 4 kilograms, whatever it was, and wouldn't fit properly. And like building a wall, they built it like that. And White Rock Quarries with the truck written on the trucks that brought the metal along. It was all spread, this, that, and the other. Plenty of horses were used, and it was, you know, it's a fantastic road now because of the fantastic way it was built in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Trams used to run down it.
Oh yes, the tram always went from Perth up to Claremont. There were various sorts. There were two sorts of trams. There was what they called the bogie. A bogie is a set of wheels that, they're on a pivot under the tram, and the larger trams had a bogie each end. That meant they had 4 wheels each end, so on 8 wheels. And there was what they called the rattler or the belly shaker, and it had 4 wheels altogether. It was only half the length, and it was just like a large pram, and it just wriggled around, and it all over the place. It got up an awful gait, and coming down the hill one day, one came in our front yard, you know, Barnsley's tram it was called. And so it was there for about 10 days, and was it a skeleton just about when they came, but we'd just about wrecked it, all the kids. We rang and pulled and turned and twisted everything in us by the time they came to take it away. And strangely enough, living here is only twice anything's ever damaged our fence. That was that tram came in, and I think the day we built a new wall in Stirling Highway, a university student came up from the university racing somebody else and came straight through the new brick wall with all the mortar was wet. In all those years, this property has been lived on for 100 years. There are the only two things that have come through the fence that I know of. It's strange. You think it would happen more often. But I think those big steel trolley bus poles frighten everybody. You know, they give them a bit of respect. But they'll be going shortly, of course.
Tell us about your family life. What sort of people were your father and mother?
My father came from a farming. Well, his father was an engineer, but he had what they called a weak chest or something, and he was told to go out the back of Queensland, the dry country, and he tried farming, and he wasn't any good at it. And my father grew up on the farm, and I think three wives. My father was the progeny of the third marriage, but there were a number of kids, and they couldn't afford to keep them on the farm. The family was broken up and sent to various relatives, and my father was one of those. He got a job in a bank in Brisbane, made an error by cashing a not negotiable check for a friend, and it bounced, and they gave him the option of leaving the bank or going to Western Australia. Well, he needed a job, and so he came to Western Australia. Apparently it was considered not a very good place to be in those days. Well, it had ruined the gold rush and all the toughs that were here, I suppose. My mother was worked in a millinery factory. She was a feather specialist, an ostrich feather specialist. A man from Rhodesia saw her working there. Waited outside, and after work he spoke to her and said, you're wasting your time, come with me to the West. And she did. She came over here, and he was a furrier, the Rhodesian Fur Company, and he started the business, put her in it to run it. He eventually turned out to be a gambler and a drunk. The business seemed to prosper, and my father and mother met in the same boarding house in East Perth, got married. My father stayed in the bank. They set up their own business, a small business in the Hearn's Arcade. The same piece of property is actually still there. You can see it now. They're pulling down the old shop in Perth. I saw it the other day. And they had their own business, and they went on from there and went further and further along Hay Street to 672 Hay Street. Eventually that building was bought by the bank they banked with. They were kicked out and bought the building next door themselves. And we had that until about 1970 when they decided to build the City Arcade through there, so we got out of there. We had a couple of shops in Piccadilly Arcade, but our manufacturing ability was greater than our retail, now only being reduced to the small outlets. So we just wound the business down very gradually. I did. My parents were no longer taking interest.
You mentioned that you went to Guildford Grammar School. What were your parents' political beliefs? Were they monarchists? Were they...
Yes. Yeah. My mother was more so that way than my father. I don't think my father was. I think Dad believed when you're dead, you're dead. I don't care what anybody says, and I don't think he cared very much whether there was a king or a queen or anything else. I think I really take after him more than my mother. Dad was... He's not hard. They were both what I call tough. Not tough in the sense of being larrikins or anything like that. They were just moral... had a tough moral fibre. You know, and I can remember my father in his 70s working a cross-cut saw, you know, and he could saw the damn thing all day, chopping up old timber for the fire or something like that, you know, and he's well into his 70s. They were frugal. They didn't want all newfangled gadgets. I mean, we talked him into buying a new car. I forget the date was. It was a Ford Falcon. And I think he paid 800 and something pounds for it, something like that it was. And I said, now, Dad, you want to get an air conditioner and a radio and power steering? I don't want anything. I just want a motor car just like I've been driving, he said, an air newer one. I don't want an air conditioner. I don't want a radio and I don't want power steering. I don't need any of that stuff. That was him, austere.
What do you think your parents' opinions were of the Empire, for instance?
I don't know that they thought very much about it. I think they both thought the world of Churchill, as I can recall, during the war, and they probably appreciated the Queen, I know, but don't forget, they worked their soul cases out. They worked from the early 20s, or during the First World War, must have been, because I've heard them talk stories about that, and they worked, they told me, till 3 o'clock in the morning sometimes. Sometimes they just went to sleep at work and woke up in the morning and went on again, you know. I don't know if they had a wash or not, I don't know, but things were tough.
During the Depression.
Yes. Yeah, but that didn't... We're only just getting out of it in 1936 in this country. The date sticks in my mind, my father saying it to me. And when the war started in 1939, he said, good God, you know, we're just starting to get out of all our problems and now we're into another lot, you know. And they, of course, both remember the First World War, and it was devastating to them to have to think of, you know... And those few years ago, they got out of one, now they're having another one.
Did you have relatives that had been in the First World War?
No. No. Because my father was a Queenslander, my mother was an only child, so I had no aunties and uncles from my mother's side. Her mother lived in Victoria. I don't know what happened to the thing. She was the child of the second husband or whatever. Anyway, that all fell to pieces. They weren't very, very wealthy nor anything like that. And my father had stepbrothers, but we never saw them.
Mm. What stories did they tell you about the First World War?
Nothing. Virtually nothing. No. Nothing. I wasn't home that much. Mm-hmm. But my tragedy of my life was, to me and to my son and my wife, is that I didn't live in a family atmosphere where you talked about things at the dinner table or told to shut up. I mean, I only came home on holidays. And most of those holidays, I went away somewhere else. I went down to a farm in Borden with a friend of mine.
Well, tell us then what you spoke about, or what your teachers spoke about at school when the problems in Europe began, when Hitler first started to be talked about as a political figure.
They didn't talk much about it. The things I remember mostly are about the Japanese, when the Japanese... You see, the one in Europe wasn't our war. It wasn't with, there was no conscription for that. They could only conscript you for service in Australia or its, there was an expression, this dependency. So I think we had some, like New Guinea and the Solomon Islands were about the only places they could send we conscripts to. They couldn't send us anywhere else. So, that, you know, if you wanted to go to it, do your best. But when the Jap started and conscription was brought in, I remember them saying, oh, look, it won't be last, the Jap, because the Japanese have got no raw resources. Look, they haven't got any iron or steel or coal or petrol or rubber. They've got nothing. They can't afford to run a war. 2 weeks later, just about, they're knocking on our front door. They've got all the iron and ore and rubber they want in the Malay Peninsula, you know. Now, they were the days when they told us at school that man could never go to the moon because the fastest way of travel was the Flying Scotsman on a train, and there's no way it could carry enough coal to go that distance. I remember that. I mean, it might not be the exact words, but that was the interpretation, that you'd never get there, you know. It was just hard and fast thinking.
So it wasn't really until the Japanese threat that war really started to enter into your mind.
Not my mind, reality. No. I remember the night it was declared by Bob Menzies, and I remember we were in the kitchen at home, and I heard him say it over the radio in the kitchen, and my mother nearly passed out. She said, oh my God, you know, sort of, oh, you know, and they both were quite shocked by it, you know, that we should be in the war, having, you know, there's still people limping around one arm and one leg from the first one, you know. So yes, it wasn't very pleasant, that part of it. I remember that.
What did they say to you?
Well, I don't think they said anything. I think that's about all they said, but it didn't worry me, I don't think. I don't know how old I was. Was I 16 or something, or 15? And growing up in a, I wasn't streetwise at all, having brought up in a boarding school. I was able to look after myself. I was tough. I had to.
Did your friends talk to you about
at school
the war?
No. I had a couple of friends in Nedlands who lived up the road. One was Jim Baker. He wanted to be in the army, book by crook. He said, "Come on, let's be in." He said, "Oh, I'll join the Signal Corps," and he joined the Signal Corps. And Jim Baker, he went off and joined the Air Force. He survived the Air Force. I don't know how, why, where, or when. I don't know what happened to him. And Peter James, he was in New Guinea, one of the very early people in New Guinea, because I remember his mother saying to my mother something about, what's my son doing up there and your son's not in it, or something or other, you know. I don't know where I was at the time, in some training camp or something around here, but I wasn't in New Guinea where he was. And he was one of the sort of the first group that, in amongst, almost the first group that stopped the Japs. You know, the Choco. We were called Chocos, we conscripts.
Why were you called Choco?
I don't know, chocolate soldier, whatever that meant, I don't know. That was it. You were called a Choco. And it was a derogatory statement. It was meant to be. Something from chocolate.
Because you hadn't volunteered.
Yes, yeah. Because you hadn't volunteered, mind you. You could. You're not supposed to get into your 18, so I suppose they gave you the option. I don't know. I've forgotten. But, anyway, we were Chocos. It was a derogatory thing. But the Chocos were the first people who stopped the Japs on Kokoda Trail, just outside Moresby or somewhere. I don't know however many started. There were only 9 of them left by the time the Japs had finished. The Japs, something like that, and the Japs turned around. Then the AOF came along, you know, so on. But
tell us a little bit about the Japanese coming into the war. It was December 7th, 41, when they bombed Pearl Harbor.
Hmm.
Did that mean anything to you?
No, yes. Yeah, oh, yes, I'm sure it did. I don't know. December, when? 41. Yeah, well, I'd already had my call-up notice by then. It was January the 7th or 4th in 42 when I was called up.
Mm-hmm. By February 42 they were in Singapore.
Yeah.
80,000 defenders or more had been captured and become POWs, and it was seen as the biggest capitulation in British history.
Yeah.
What sort of things do you recall of that?
Oh, panic. It was sheer panic. It really was. I mean, my wife will tell you that her father gave her mother a gun and said, you know, if the Japs come, shoot the kids and then yourself. As he was in the army in some construction battalion, he'd been in the First World War and he battered up for second helping. We were all rushed up the coast, up the northwest here. in terrible conditions, you know. We were just sent up there. What the hell we would have done, I don't know. No training, nothing, you know. It was dreadful. It was just a stupid thing.
February 42 as well, they were starting to bomb down.
Yeah.
That was really bringing...
They were going to be here any minute. They reckon they would come ashore. One of the places would be around Donga or somewhere like that, just north of Geraldton or just south of Geraldton and those places. They were going to come ashore there, but thankfully they didn't. And there was talk of the Brisbane line. I think there was some line they drew from Adelaide to Brisbane or something. They were going to try and defend that bit and give the rest of the Japs.
What were some of the things that you recall as far as propaganda regarding the Japanese?
Well, of course, their atrocities were there. What weren't true, they made up, obviously. I mean, it was this war all over, isn't it? The propaganda's put about the atrocities of them. But you're talking about the early days, of course, yeah. And, you know, we all heard about the nurses being machine gunned, and we heard about the death marches. And, of course, in the army, we used to get all the rumours and so on. So yeah, they were terrible people. Most of it was true too. I don't think they could exaggerate enough at what they did. I mean, we'd read, and I think there were photographs of them. And see, don't forget, in China, the most peculiar thing I think about the Japanese war, they still had more troops in China while they were doing all this than they had down in Southeast Asia, right till the end of the war. If they'd released all the troops from China, that would walk barefooted over everybody. It's peculiar why they didn't. But they were using live Chinese for bayonet practice. You know, they tied them up to a post with one hand, and then the Japs practiced on them with a bayonet, you know, until there were too many little pieces, and they'd tie another one up. You know, they're just, life meant nothing to them. Absolute animals, mongrels. Don't ask me why they have to be like that, I don't know. But part of their upbringing. I mean, they did nail Australians to trees if they got one alive. They stood them against a tree, took their hands around the back and nailed their bloody hands to the tree. Sort of a vertical crucifixion thing. You know. Then practice on you with a bayonet and all that sort of thing. You know. They're terrible buggers.
Tell us about joining up. What was it like signing on?
Dreadful. I didn't want it in the first place. You know, I had had enough of being told what I was doing in a boarding school. I just got away from all that. Now I was a free spirit. And now, God, I was in for a second helping. Even though I was in the cadets at school, I think that was mandatory, everybody did it, and I actually was a cadet lieutenant. So I knew the rudiments of it, the marching and the sloping arms and present arms and the heel clicking and saluting and all the rest of it. But you got to notice, and I think it said, to present yourself to the Claremont Drill Hall, which is just the other side of Bayview Terrace going west. It's on now on the right hand, it was on the right hand side about 100 yards along, was the Claremont Drill Hall. And it said to present yourself with a cut bunch, a pair of braces, shorts, a pair of long half hose with garters. You had garters, half hose, shorts, and a pair of braces. You're going to fight someone's war and you've got to provide your own gear. That's how we started off. So you got in a long queue and you went along and they did all the things they did. They gave you a number. First thing they did was give you a number, and then they... isn't it funny, it burned into my brain, number 46722. I can remember it now. W46722. And I met... The bloke in front or behind me was a fellow called Jack Howe. He was a scholar from modern school. And in those days, you didn't go to modern school unless you were smart. He won his way there on a scholarship, and he was a smart guy. And he was 6 jumps ahead of me all the way through the army. And he even got out before me. He was an incredible man. He was a great, great friend. And I met him in all odd places. I think I even met him up in Bougainville again, I think. But yeah, you signed on. You went through, had the usual sort of rough medical, stick out your tongue and say ah, and drop your tweeds and cough, and okay, you'll do. Give you a pat on the back and a kick in the behind, and right, next please. And they, you went along a long table, and they gave you a hat and a shirt and a pair of trousers and socks and boots and gaiters. Can you believe it? They wore in 1918. You know, a bit of cloth you wrapped around your trousers and around your legs. You know, and eventually you got a rifle. You got and a ground sheet and a hat, and there was nothing different about the equipment they gave her that our fathers used in 1914. That's exactly the same stuff.